Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, a podcast celebrating chick lit and the so-called guilty pleasures you're sort of done feeling guilty about. My name is Caroline Donoghue, and when I released my first novel this year, I found myself being asked the same two questions over and over again. One, did I think of my novel as chick lit? And two, was I offended if it were called that? Which is weird because all the best women I know are also devoted fans of chick lit, and this podcast is dedicated to examining what's good, great, and occasionally questionable about the genre. Today, I'm joined by journalist, author, and film critic Helen O'Hara to talk about what might be the most questionable book and definitely our most controversial author in our first season. We're talking about Louise Mensch's 1995 debut, Career Girls. Hi,
yeah.
Helen.
Hi. I stand by it. It's an interesting example of the genre, I reckon. Written when she was Louise Bagshaw, and
yes,
for my money, she was a lot better as a writer then because there was much more sex in her books. Then
right,
when she reinvented herself.
Keep the Bagshaw, because Mensch,
yeah,
decidedly not a Mensch.
No, you know what I mean? Not in terms of the dirty bits, for sure.
No. Yeah. So what brought you to this book and why did you choose it today?
I genuinely don't remember what exactly started it. I remember it was going around in first year at uni. It must have been fairly freshly published at that point. It wasn't 95, but it wasn't that long after.
Am I right in thinking that you were in Oxford as
I
well?
I was, yeah. So
okay,
that was another thing, because the book is partly set at Oxford University. So I think that was probably part of the reason that somebody picked it up, mm-hmm, maybe thinking this would be an instructive manual in some way for our university careers. It is not. But it was interesting in that sense. So it was basically being passed around like a dirty book was in
school.
So
weird that, like, people in at university age were still doing that. I thought that was a thing that you did in secondary school.
Well, I mean, you have to remember that it's Oxford, so we're all a bit backwards.
We're all
a bit backwards. It was not the most, you know, shagadelic of universities, let's say.
Well, if you read Career Girls, I think you'd think very differently.
Yes.
So I'm going to give a quick sort of summary,
yes,
of the novel before we get properly into it. So we start with Rowena Gordon, who is a well-bred child of the British elite. She's also fantastically attractive and a kind of an ice blonde, you know, very slim, elegant, crystal lady sort of way. So she meets Topaz Rossi, an Italian-American scholarship kid at Oxford University. And these two meet there, and because they're both, you know, so ruthless, so beautiful, so driven by their ambition, they immediately become best friends. And that friendship is torn apart very dramatically when Rowena betrays the friendship by sleeping with Topaz's boyfriend, which turns into a lifelong grudge and rivalry. And sort of spurned on by that mutual hatred, they both go to the top of their chosen industries. Rowena is in music and Topaz is in publishing. And they sort of launch these missiles across each other throughout their long careers, mm-hmm, and disrupting the entire media industry at the same time.
Yeah.
And it is one of the most compelling reads I have ever read. This is bluer than blue. Like every 10 pages there is a sex scene, and
yep,
it's sometimes like about half the time an incredibly disturbing sex scene.
Yeah.
And you know, there's like constant references to what people are wearing and how curves are being poured into people's outfits and how like people's erections are bursting against their jeans.
Yeah. There's a lot of that. The poor men must be suffering.
There is a lot of that. There's a lot of like stalemate, trashy things,
mm-hmm,
but ultimately the story is flipping good, isn't it?
The story is really solid, yeah. And I think like it is part of that kind. It's kind of the Judith Krantz tradition of chick lit, mm-hmm, in the sense of like it's all about excess and it's all about, you know, name dropping brands and talking about how rich everybody is and talking about how glamorous their lives are, which is just kind of ridiculous fun. I mean, a lot of it doesn't make any sense really, and it especially doesn't make sense 20 years later when people are getting rich in publishing. Like, that's not a thing nowadays.
Right. But it feels like quite plausible because this is very much a 90s book.
Yes.
Like, so like magazines have endless money. The music industry has endless money. And
yeah,
now if you've ever worked in either of those industries, you know that like, you know, it's bare light bulbs and ham sandwiches that are just sweating under...
That is
under rock stars.
That is 100% true. And even like the Oxford stuff at the beginning. Okay, so, you know, she was a bit older than me. She's mm-hmm. she's gone through a bit before I did, but like so little of that is familiar to me. Like Cherwell, the paper that Rossi writes for when she's at Oxford, that exists. That's a thing.
Oh, does it?
The Oxford Union exists. That's a thing that, you know, Rowena runs for president of the Oxford Union. And I get that there's a part of Oxford that I didn't really do because I wasn't a rich kid and there was a rich stratum mm-hmm. on top that I didn't have any truck with, because why would I want to be friends with those people? But even allowing for that, so much of the rest just doesn't make any sense. Like Rowena's meant to be at Christchurch, which is the same college as this boyfriend of Topaz's that she cheats on him with. But it says she, you know, she was going through the Gate Lodge four times a week to see him. I'm like, she was never going there otherwise. Like, you live your entire life in your college. You're never there apart yeah. from the Gate Lodge. Like, this makes no sense.
It also has a weird, like, you would swear, because it's, you know, the Oxford bit, they're set in the late 80s.
Yeah, I think so.
And you would swear they're talking about the 1930s, the way that yeah. Mensch sort of creates this world. Because, like, they're going to these balls where they're, Rowena is at one point wearing a Regency period gown.
Yeah, somebody wears a crinoline dress.
Yeah, it's like not just that one person. It's like, oh, she saw swathes of crinoline yeah. sweeping through the halls.
It's like, I mean, the Oxford, you know, it is weird. There are these black tie galas, like a lot more than a normal university would have them. Boys buy tuxedos when they go up and they wear them all 3 years. Like, that's a thing. Mm-hmm. But it's not crinolines. Like, give us, come on, yeah. just cut us a little bit of a break, really.
There's one very interesting thing that I think probably, I've never been to an Ivy League, Ivy League. I've never been to a fancy school.
Right.
So I don't know how true this is, but one thing that felt like it might ring true in those Oxford days, which are about the first quarter of the book, maybe. Topaz is this sort of gutsy Italian-American scholarship kid who falls in with the elite crowd or sure. children of the elite.
Yeah.
And Rowena, who is, you know, a member of the elite herself, kind of goes through the first few pages of the book being like, I, you know, I'm completely rejecting the snobbery of this class that I come from. It completely doesn't interest me. I love my gutsy Italian-American friend. But then Rowena is very much like, when she sees her friend going out with one of these people.
Yeah, like, having something she decides she wants.
Yes, going out with the guy who's a rower and he's like beautiful and blonde and whatever. She decides like, no, how dare you march into my class and take it? So there's this very interesting hypocrisy and double standard from the beginning. It's very rooted in class, which does feel like it could be part of the Oxford experience.
Yeah, and just the general life experience. I think that's part of, you know, I think that's part of, you know, racism, for example. You know, it's like, oh, well, we're all for those people doing well. And then suddenly when they do well, people are a bit like, oh, well, hang on a minute, you know.
Yeah.
Are they taking our opportunities? Whatever. I think there's an element of that just in human nature, probably. But it is probably part of an Oxford thing. I weirdly, my experience of the uni, I'm sorry to bang on about this, but my experience of the uni was it was the least class conscious place I've been in some ways, in the sense that I was aware of how smart most people were, and I was aware of how hard most people worked, and I wasn't aware of how much money they had. Now, I would say that the negative reason for that is that we were all degrees of middle class. Mm. Most people that I knew were degrees of middle class, either, you know, rich middle class, poorer middle class, whatever. And that's why we didn't really talk about it. And I think that was probably not the experience for like a working class kid coming up to Oxford. I think they probably were more aware of it and did have to be, you know, more conscious or whatever else at that time. But for me, like I wasn't, there were people that I found out literally in my final year had gone to like super fancy public schools and just never made a deal of it. They weren't those people, or they didn't act like those people. And equally, there were people who went to bog standard comprehensives who came up to Oxford and started acting like they were the sons of royalty. Like, yeah. It is a weird place, but it's not, my experience wasn't as class ridden as this one, basically. And again, that might be me being weird and not Louise Bagshaw being wrong.
I'm actually really interested in your perspective here, in kind of our shared perspective, because both of us are Irish.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's as much, I don't know what the word for it, not as much focus on class in Ireland, because class does exist, but it's not as rigid as it is here. And when I first moved here, I was really bad at spotting what the tellers were for what an incredibly posh or privileged person was. Because like, I thought, like, okay, someone who's got a long, fancy, double-barreled name and plays rugby or sails, that's a fancy person. But actually, everyone around me who I was making friends with was like, oh no, well, he's from this obscure part of the country, you know, he's got money. You know, it's like there's a lot more codifiers that I didn't know about.
That's probably true. There was stuff that I just didn't pick up on at first because I didn't know enough to know what it meant.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, there's an element of that. But I mean, I did become gradually aware, like, you know, if somebody had, like in those days, if somebody had a big flat screen TV in their room,
yeah,
you're like, whoa, you've got
that's
money.
Wealth.
Or actually, certainly my first year, if somebody had a laptop, you're like, whoa, you're a bit fancy, aren't you?
Yeah.
Because the rest of us went to the computer room and just used the college computers mm-hmm. because it's, I am old, and this was olden days.
Oh, no, that
kids.
Was like, I mean, I went to uni in 2008 and I was using the computer.
Okay, that makes me feel better. So. Okay, good. But genuinely, like, you sort of gradually picked up on some clues that, okay, this person has more money than I do.
But it's like that difference between money and class.
Mm.
And that is in the novel a lot.
A lot.
Because, you know, Rowena is this elite or whatever, and Topaz, despite the fact they get to similar places in their career, they both become absolute titans of their industry.
Yeah.
But there's always this sense that Topaz is a grasping, grimy little journalist who's always... essentially what Topaz does throughout the novel is she digs up dirt on Rowena or the musical acts that are around Rowena, and she puts that dirt in the papers.
Mm-hmm.
And then she slowly dismantles Rowena's career by doing this.
Yeah.
As a pure act of revenge. And she also ruins many people's lives in the process.
But then so does Rowena. So one of Topaz's moves is to have one of her magazines go after this musical act that Rowena is supporting.
What are they called? Atomic Mass.
Atomic Mass, which isn't a bad band name, actually.
No,
that's
it's a very
solid.
Believable band name.
So Topaz goes after Atomic Mass, and Rowena and her friends, particularly Michael Krebs, who I think we'll be talking about more later.
Yes.
Retaliate by essentially, this guy Michael Krebs is a very important music producer. He's known throughout and loved throughout the whole industry. So he basically calls up all his friends and gets them to stop advertising in this particular magazine,
mm-hmm.
and essentially shuts down the magazine.
Yeah. And then later on in the novel, the magazine is shut down and
completely.
No one even mentioned it. And as a journalist, you're thinking, oh, well, hundreds of people just lost their jobs.
No, there's a line about that where she says that, you know, Topaz tried to reassign everybody within American. But that's it. Yeah. Rowena just killed a magazine for Topaz. Good work, ladies.
Great work, ladies. But it's so compelling.
Mm.
I mean, obviously, the plot's very compelling. But what's even more compelling is the parallels with Louise Mensch, nay Bagshaw, and the whole figure of who Louise Mensch is, which I don't think we can get any further in this podcast without talking about a little.
Yeah, it's because when she wrote this, I mean, this is a very Thatcherite novel in some ways, isn't it? It's very much the sort of, it feels a lot
that's a
more
80s
way
of
than 90s
it.
In
yes.
some ways. It's very much these people pulling them up by their boots, by their own bootstraps. Even Rowena, who comes from class and money and has gone to all the best schools and all that, she basically is disowned when she goes into music, and her family are never mentioned again except negatively.
Family is never mentioned.
Yeah.
Like, the only people that these women have connections with are the older, more powerful men they're sleeping with every 10 pages.
That is another issue, yes.
And the people they are crushing.
Yes.
Like, they don't really have friends. There are some token friends who are there to deliver some new storylines.
Basically.
But there aren't, there's no real warmth. No one has fun in this novel unless they're being sexually abused by their older boyfriend.
yeah, that's not unfair.
The fun is from having sex and crushing people.
Crushing. Oh, they do like listening to music or journalism.
They do, yes. They
so
do
they
have a passion
us.
For their work.
Yes. But yeah, so Mensch herself, or Bagshaw as she was, Mensch as she is. Well, first of all, let's get into the Mensch thing. So one of the people thanked, did you notice this in the book? In the thanks for this book, it goes, and finally, my thanks to the most appropriately named man in the music industry, Peter Mensch, for taking me along for the ride. And he actually comes up a couple of times in the story as a character.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, each time this book goes out of its way to say how great he is and how you shouldn't mess with him because he's really powerful.
Right.
So that's all background. There's a guy called Peter Mensch. He was in the music industry. He was, I think, a promoter and manager. And Louise Bagshaw obviously met him in the course of her research. Years later, she married him.
But she actually met him because she was president of the Oxford Uni Rock Club.
Yes.
Saw him on TV, had a crush on him, kept writing letters to him to get him to come talk at school, and then just essentially stalked him throughout his career.
Essentially, yeah. So happy ending, I guess, in that sense. But it's weird that it parallels the book so much because Rowena meets this older, very powerful figure in the music industry called Michael Krebs. And
the least romantic name I've ever heard.
Terrible name, isn't it?
Krebs.
Krebs with a K. It's not It's not.
Yeah, the naming of characters in this book is a whole other subject we'll get onto in a minute, but continue.
So he's much older than she is, but they perform this very sort of dominant, submissive affair where she's very submissive to him and he's very, very dominant of her. He refuses to leave his wife. He's married. He absolutely won't give up on the affair with her, but absolutely also won't break up his marriage. And this basically goes on throughout the whole book until really last minute, like literally last page of the book, he turns up and says, no, I've left her. Let's live happily ever after. But it's a little weird, isn't it? The parallels are just a bit weird.
So that is not the only parallel between Louise Mensch's private life and Rowena Gordon. Mm-hmm. Again, Rowena for your heroine?
I don't know.
Rowena and Topaz? So I really hate the trend of a woman writes about an area of the world that she knows about from her personal life, and then everyone thinks it's an autobiography. This is something I got when with Promising Young Women, because it's set in the advertising world, and I worked in the advertising world. And yeah, I wrote my first novel based on that because that's the world I know really well. But then people were asking me sort of like, oh, so who did you sleep with? Who'd you do this? And it was really insulting because I was like, how dare you? You know, that of course I can make things up. And I think it happens a lot in discussion of female novelists.
That's true.
That the idea that women sort of draw on their personal lives and men
exclusively
can invent things.
Yes.
But in our friend Louise cases.
In this case, yeah.
The parallels are as such. Rowena went to a private girls' Catholic boarding school, then went to Christ Church at Oxford, then became a music PR, a very successful one, I think, and then married a producer.
Yeah. All of that could be said about the author.
Yes, absolutely all of it, down to the boarding school.
But I mean, we have to cut her some slack, probably. This is her first novel.
Yes, and she was really young when she wrote this book. She was 22 when she signed her first book deal.
Which is really good going, so done in that sense. But it sometimes does show. I think there's some bits where she kind of overplays her hand. There's a couple of bits where she maybe hasn't edited, or somebody else hasn't edited her that well. You know, there's a bit, and I'm still trying to figure out this outfit. Right, there's a bit, and I'm probably not going to be able to find it to quote it exactly. But there's a bit where she talks about Rowena's curled up on a chair with her. Her breasts do a lot of thrusting, but they're thrusting up against the fabric of her blouse.
Yeah.
And then literally a line later, it says she's wearing a blue Bill Blass dress.
So quick outfit change.
I'm genuinely trying to figure out how that dress works, that you can still see the thrusting.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Or is thrusting just, does that mean being present, or does it mean sort of, poking through almost? I'm genuinely concerned about the physics here. I want to understand what cuts of dress and blouse still allows a clear outline to be perceived.
It's a difficult one.
It's a tough one.
It's,
I mean, people can maybe draw diagrams at home. I don't know. Maybe it's a sort of weird, one of those weird dresses that sort of comes up to just under your boobs and then just has straps.
It was the 90s. People were doing things with straps and sleeves, the likes of which we haven't seen since.
Oh, I still miss the sleeves in the 90s. You know when boys used to wear a long t-shirt sleeve and then a short t-shirt sleeve over
it? Yeah, I miss
it.
Curtains on boys.
Yeah. The 90s were great.
And they were especially great for Louise Mensch, apparently. I want to talk a little bit about what we think happened there with her. I don't know if everybody knows this, but so everything we just said about Rowena / Louise, she was kind of, I think she described herself for a long time as being a socially liberal but fiscally conservative.
Yeah, the sort of Arnold Schwarzenegger approach to politics.
Yeah, totally. And a bit of a Blairite as well, I think, in the 90s. And then she became a conservative MP. She founded several websites, one of which, by the way, is called Heat Street, which is the name of the album that the Atomic Mass
produced. I hadn't even put that together before.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I was doing a lot of simultaneous reading of this book and her Wikipedia page last night, as you can probably tell. And then, she became a journalist she's been described as a conspiracy theorist. She has a series of kind of failed websites, one of which was called Mention.
Mention, so her own name plus N on the end. Is
yes.
In, and that was meant to replace Twitter and didn't really take off.
No, it did.
Did it?
You're not on Mention?
Oh, no, really? Am I missing out? Oh, man.
Oh, God, I've been trying to add you on Mention all these years.
That's why I keep getting all that spam. No, I'm kidding.
And so, yeah, a series of websites like that. And then she's just writing for her own political blog. And she kind of updates it once every few months. And mostly with a kind of a nonsensical anti-Trump story. Mm. And she sort of seems to be almost making things up. And then every now and then she'll sort of hit on something that actually turns out to be true. And she's been incredibly controversial and also just batty. Like she once bullied Abby Tomlinson, who was the 16-year-old who founded the Millifandom back in the whatever year that election was, bullied her off Twitter and like basically wouldn't apologize for screaming at a teenager online. And now just it makes no sense to me how somebody who was once pursuing the noble call of like being a fun bunkbuster romance writer is now just yelling at people, at teenagers online, you know?
Yeah, it's been a bit weird. I mean, I get the sort of no apologies kind of, you know, stance for, like, I feel like that fits with a lot of her characters, not just in this book, but in other ones as well. Tall Poppies is one that springs to mind. That was another classic, genuinely. It's
very strange because her characters, they're all like, everyone seems to be like, oh, the most brilliant woman in her industry. Mm. All these women are brilliant and they're smart and they're talented. But like most of the evidence of their brilliance and talent are them walking into rooms, yelling at people. Until they get their way and then walking out again, just like them going like, I'm the smartest woman in this industry, Michael Krebs, and you'd be a damn fool if you didn't see that. And them going, well, she has a point.
I mean, I can argue, can I? It is, I mean, there's something very satisfying about that. And I think that is one of the reasons that I do like these books.
Right.
You know, it's very much, you know, she said herself, it's not Cinderella stories. Like, this is women going out and doing it for themselves. Mm-hmm. This is very Annie Lennox and Aretha Franklin.
Oh,
sisters
yes.
are doing it for themselves. Not always in a very sisterly way, but they are. And that is kind of fun just because it gives the books a bit more to work with. It's not the usual, I don't want to say this too denigratingly, but there are a lot of books, there are a lot of romances and TV shows and movies where the only thing keeping the couple apart is some completely spurious misunderstanding that hasn't been cleared up when it should have been, and therefore it will all come out and there will be a sense of betrayal and it will be awful. And like, you're just waiting for this betrayal and you can get it over with and then you can get back together.
The famous one being, you dated me for a bet?
Exactly. It's always something so super
something
contrived.
I still say to my boyfriend every morning, by the way. I'm like, it was a bet? You're dating me for a bet? It's been 4 years.
We have a dog.
You got this dog as a bet? You were writing an article about me? Those are the two big ones. It was
Those
a bet
two, yeah.
or you were writing an article about me.
Yeah, that's always... And the thing was, at least in this case, the problems tend to be more like, God, I hate her because she's getting in my way at work.
Mm-hmm.
Or God, I hate him because he's getting in my way at work. And that tends to be what they need to overcome. And that's a lot more satisfying in the sense of, that's a thing that could happen to a person.
Oh, totally.
So it's
interesting that like so much of the book, there's incredible fantasy, incredible wealth, like, and it's very, some of it you're like, okay, this sex scene could never happen in real life. they're like in a green room at like the biggest rock concert in the world, and he's like tying her to the beams on the ceiling. Why are there beams on the ceiling? I don't know. All of that is so out there. But then actually when you get to the work detail, it feels very well researched. It feels very solid. It's completely compelling.
Mm.
And I bloody loved it. Like, I mean, I just want to give her credit where credit's due because I thought all of that stuff was really brilliant.
Yeah. She's, you know, so as a music AR, she's going out to scummy clubs and watching usually rubbish bands.
Yeah.
For the sort of the tabloid scene, she's, like you say, she's raking muck basically to try and make it through. And then she's kind of redesigning magazines. And even some of her ideas for redesigning magazines are quite interesting.
They're good ideas, most
of
them.
Yeah, they're pretty solid. And not all of them have been done in real life very much. So
it's kind of
interesting what Topaz comes up with or what Louise Mensch comes up with to
do that
stuff.
There's a brilliant one where she's like, Topaz makes the decision that she's not going to put Thin models or Kate Moss, and this is like the era of Kate Moss.
Yeah.
Her big, I mean, every year is her era.
Sure.
But she's like, girls don't really care about Kate Moss. Girls care about Nancy Kerrigan.
Yeah.
And you could replace Nancy Kerrigan with Jennifer Lawrence or whatever. Like, they care, like, she's constantly having to explain to much older and much more powerful men, like, you don't understand these people like I understand these people. And obviously, the magazine editor in rom-coms is a really hallowed job. But I think Topaz is among the most convincing.
Oh yeah, she literally does feel like an actual editor, and stuff like in the same sort of sequence as that, she's talking about not having designer clothes in their teen magazine, which really shouldn't be a very difficult thing to figure out, and yet it feels like it's taken a long time for teen magazines to come around to the idea that these kids are going to wear Gap. They're not going to wear Gucci.
Yeah.
So
there's a great scene where she's literally yelling at these models to get into their Gap because and they're completely incensed by it.
Quite, she's right. I mean, she seems like a good magazine editor. Fair play to her.
One of my other favorite scenes of that was like, one of her love interests. By the way, another thing about Topaz is that she meets this man called something Rosen.
Nathan
Rosen, who is her boss at her first magazine.
Yes.
Gets together with him.
Yeah.
He seems like a lovely man.
He seems super nice.
He seems like, actually, he's the only nice person in the book. He's just like, he really believes in her. He really tries to hold off on getting with his employee. Eventually, they fall in love.
Yeah.
They get married. She's a bit pissed off.
Engaged.
They get engaged. She's a bit pissed off that he doesn't want to have sex all of the time the way she needs to. But there's this lovely scene, and it's probably the only domestically sweet scene in the entire book where they're just sort of at home and they have a bit of sex on the kitchen table because why not?
Sure, of course.
They're sort of like having a bit of a joke in bed, and she's like, I'd really love some coffee ice cream. He goes out to get some coffee ice cream and dies.
You monster. You just laughed at the guy dying. He got hit by a car.
Hit by a drunk driver.
Do you know what? I was rereading this book, obviously. I read it back in the day, and I was coming up to that scene. In my memory, he died of a heart attack. And I'll tell you why that was my memory, is because the book cannot shut up about how old he is, right?
Yeah, and he's like 58.
At this point, she's like 22. And no, he's not 58. He's
38.
39.
Okay.
Right? He's 39. And the book acts like he's about to drop dead at any moment. Like,
I know!
He keeps talking about how he needs to go to the gym to stay in shape because, oh my God, he's, so old. And he keeps worrying about his thinning hair and worrying about keeping up with his young, virile girlfriend.
And it's the place really where, you can tell that a 22-year-old wrote this book.
Yeah, very
what's
much
the oldest age I can think of? 39.
It is hilarious. And the age difference, this is a thing with all of the characters,
yes.
Really.
Older Jewish men who are incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And kind of mean are catnip to these characters.
Basically that. I mean, I think the powerful thing makes sense because I feel like if you're a powerful woman, you want to be with your equal.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the time. And I think that's one of the things that creates a lot of problems for women who are powerful and accomplished and everything else, because men are not taught to find that attractive and to seek that out.
Yeah.
And women are. And I think there's a bit of an imbalance there. In terms of the age thing as well, I think men are taught to want younger women and women are taught to go for older men. And it's creepy in this book. I genuinely think it's anti-feminist for women to date much older men. But that's a whole other thing.
No, that's a very interesting thing, because this is something I've talked to you off air about before.
Yeah. I don't think things socially will change until young women stop dating older men. And I realise that it's unfeminist for me to tell young women what to do, so I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I want them to want to not do that. And I can't make them not want that. But like, it's a problem. But I genuinely, like, socially, I feel like it creates a huge imbalance of power in the dating game, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's, anyway.
No, I think there is something to that, and it's definitely something that is reflected a lot in this book, because there's a lot of tussle and push and pull of the concept of sleeping your way to the top, which both characters I think are accused of.
Yeah,
because both characters are very good at their jobs, and men should take a lot of care to detail that, of like how good these women are and how respected they are, how feared they are, how good their instincts are. But then there are always moments with both of them where they're essentially in a bit of trouble, but the man they're shagging kind of gets them out of it.
Yeah,
Rowena and Michael Krebs being
a good
big
example.
One. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think in all of those kind of situations, there is an element of him being, even if it's before they've gotten together, there's an element of his attraction to her playing a role in his decision to help.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a bit murky in that sense.
It's very, very interesting in terms of how it reflects on the different kinds of feminisms that have grown, evolved and been discarded over the years. Because I feel like if you compare, I feel like that feminism is grown out of that 1970s tradition of feminism where it's like, we have to be realistic about what men want from us and how we can use that against them. That's the worldview of this book. Like, okay, his sort of list of attributes and skills are the fact that he's talented and powerful and he has lots of money. My thing is that I'm very attractive and I'm very smart.
Yeah.
And that's how I'm going to, and that's very triumphed in this book. Whereas I feel now the kind of feminism that we tend to preach is about, no, we're going to all try and level each other out. We're not animals anymore. We're not going to have sexual predatory relationships in order to bolster our work relationships. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and there's a lot of people who argue that, like, that sort of 70s approach, which was more about how the way things are versus the 2018 approach was very like, let's change the way things are.
Yeah.
That was more practical.
And in some ways that might be true, but it's only going to get you so far because if you're not challenging the system, then you can only proceed so far. I mean, Topaz is a really good example of the kind of lean-in feminism. I mean, there's okay, so this is a spoiler if you haven't got there yet, but, like, she's going to get pregnant. So she's going to have, like, a tiny maternity leave because she wants to get back to work and doesn't want to miss any time. And that's entirely the decision taken by many powerful women in her position. That is absolutely, especially in America, of course, where she is at that point in her career. So it makes sense. I'm not saying it's not realistic. It's 100% realistic. It's also really freaking depressing because it shouldn't. You shouldn't have to rush back to work after having twins. Spoiler.
Twins.
Oh. To keep your job and to keep with, you know, to get back without losing position. And so many women I know have experienced some degree of, you know, prejudice or whatever, going back to work after having kids. And it's still such an issue. And it shouldn't be down to every woman rushing back after 6 weeks or 3 months or whatever. Just so she doesn't get penalized for it, you know. So that it's that kind of difference of feminism again. On one hand, you can show you're as tough as the men by going back to work almost immediately. On the other hand, you shouldn't have to be that. The species needs to continue, and that should be valued.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
While we're on the sort of subject of feminism and how it's treated on this, because both characters are feminists.
Yes.
They say they are. They're very devout in saying that they are.
And other people accuse them of it regularly.
Yeah, and they proudly lean into it. Yeah. Like, and that's some of the best moments in the book.
Yeah.
It's the most rousing. Like, well, fuck them. You are a feminist. And there's like arguments about whether who's going to take whose last name and all that kind of stuff. And it's actually really great.
Yeah.
But it's very much a feminism. It is white feminism incorporated in terms of it's feminism that cares about feminism to the extent that as long as I climb the ladder and get to the top, that's all that really matters.
Yeah. And it's also that
it's not sisterly.
Not sisterly. And it is that very individualistic approach of I got to the top so anyone can. And there is no discussion of anyone in the books who might not be as gifted as Topaz or Rowena, mm-hmm. and who may not have had the opportunities that they've had. So, it feels like, oh, look at all these wonderful people who have worked their way to the top. There's nothing to stop anyone doing that. And it's like, no, that does not prove anything. There's loads of things to stop people doing that. So, that's why I say it's a very Thatcherite book in that sense. It doesn't really acknowledge the fact that there might be other people who cannot do what these two characters do.
Yeah. The meritocracy is definitely a thing that is...
Well, there's literally a meritocrat's ball in this, where the greatest are invited. The good, they say, can take care of themselves, which is a good line in the book. but all the people who have achieved most are invited to this particular ball. And of course, both our heroines keep meeting there to throw barbs at each other. Oh,
so I don't think we can get much further in this. Mm-hmm. Without talking about the sex in the book, because we've sort of like, well, obviously, every 10 pages, there's a sex scene.
Pretty much.
Sometimes, like, at first you're like, oh, God, another sex scene, whatever. But after a while, you're like, you get used to them as being like breaking up the action. You're like, Louise?
Where's the sex scene? Come on, it's been 12 pages.
It feels
now.
Like about that time. And so I don't want to be very my dad wrote a porno about this.
Sure.
Because sex writing is hard and... people like it, right? And I think it's silly to make fun of sex writing. I think it's quite a low blow. God, there's so many double entendres just in that sentence.
I mean,
alone.
I was trying to control myself.
But I want to give you an idea, or the listeners an idea, what the dynamic of these sex scenes are. Michael Cribbs and Rowena are at this very fancy party that you mentioned earlier on. Mm-hmm. And it's just been revealed by the host that all the guests are being taken to the Florida Keys and everybody's leaving to go get the helicopter or whatever, and Rowena is instructed by her boss, Michael Cribbs, that she will not be going to Florida. She will instead be having sex with him.
Yeah.
Which is upsetting, actually. Like,
Florida sounded awesome.
To Florida,
that's
Rowena.
That's an amazing party. Everyone's going on a Gulf Stream. Come on, Michael.
Okay, so... I know what happens now, said Michael in her ear, so you won't have to wait to see. Everyone's going up to the roof garden and gets into a fleet of helicopters which ferry them to Alex Martin's private airstrip, and then two Gulfstream 4 jets take everybody out and back for 6 hours of dancing in the Florida Keys. You're kidding, breathed Rowena. Krebs made an impatient movement with his hand. No, I'm not kidding, but I want to fuck you, so you're not going. He took another look at her in that cream and rose dress, the ruby sparkling around her long neck as she moved. She reverted to type. They all did, these little rich girls playing around in business. She was a class piece, a European lady, the kind that he dreamed about in college but would have stammered in front of if he'd actually had to speak for her. Michael Krebs, twice Rowena Gordon's age, her mentor in business, her tutor in sex. He splayed his fingers over her ribcage, feeling her slight involuntary squirm. He would have her like this, exactly like this. He wouldn't let her change a thing. He wanted to see this English lady in her fine clothes, down on her knees, with her mouth around his cock, with her warm, soft lips and eager tongue working him so that he could come in her mouth. That would be first. Then a little later, before he was hard again, he'd make her take his limp prick in between her lips and hands and work them and work them back up to an erection so he could put her on her hands and knees on a hotel bed, shove up that elegant chiffon and screw her from behind. Just fuck all that British reserve right out of her. She'd have to please him like that. She'd have to earn her sex. That was very difficult for me, everyone.
You did it so well.
So that's very much the what sex is in the book.
Mm.
People have it joyously, rarely. It's always about domination and the exchange of power. And
yeah, which. So basically, reading this as a sort of, 18-year-old or whatever, mm-hmm. What was quite attractive about the sex scenes, if you like, was the fact that the women don't have to take too much in the way of initiative. It's quite easy in the sense of you don't have to start anything. Like, I feel like, you know, you don't have to kind of worry. They've got it covered. Like, they're going to be competent. They know what you want. You don't have to think about it.
That's so interesting.
And that was kind of the sort of... because if you're not quite sure what you're doing, the idea of quite a dominant lover is a good one. Because you're like, well, I don't have to... it doesn't matter that I don't know what I'm doing because he knows what he wants and it'll work for both of us.
That is such an excellent point, because Rowena, her sort of... she's unbelievably turned on by all this. She like is addicted to this man and to this sort of sex that they have. And for most of it... it's just him saying things to her and then having sex with her and her just kind of like, oh God, oh yeah. Jesus, oh my God. Like there's actually no pressure for her to be as filthy right back. She just has to sort of
be
like,
there
and like let it
yeah.
in.
Yeah. Yeah, literally just like her presence is all that's really required of her.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it just seems like, I don't want to say sex for beginners, but it kind of is a little bit. It's kind of just quite low pressure for them. Like she and Topaz are portrayed, I mean they're talked about, the book slavers over them.
Oh yeah, it's
so
very
much.
Male gazey. It's very
yeah,
they can't walk into a meeting without like, and she looked amazing as always, like, her perfect tits jiggling in her top, you
exactly,
know.
Exactly, so much of that, like every man that either of these women meet is immediately mm-hmm. insane for them. I don't think there's a gay character in the book, is there? I mean almost none. If
there's
if
a so. Brief mention of one.
Oh yeah. There's a stylist who's
yes
who's, yeah okay yeah. But basically everybody else. And all of them are obsessed with these women. And it's just quite a nice fantasy to think that all I just need to do is stand here and they're going to be like, wow, she is amazing.
It's so just weird. You know how like when you read a lot of a book at once and then you kind of, the narration is in your head. Mm-hmm. Like I was walking around my house yesterday in like leggings and a t-shirt being like, her curves were poured into her Gap leggings, her Levi's t-shirt without a stain.
I mean, I've seen you in leggings, you know, absolutely poured in.
Thank
poured
you. In. I feel poured in. Do you think there's an argument for like the sex these women have is so sort of angry and furious and insatiable? Mm. Like that is something that comes up about both of them all the time, is that they literally can't have enough.
Yeah.
And there is no too much for them. There's no UTIs in this book.
Oh, God.
Nobody gets cystitis from being banged too hard. Do you think there's a subtext that they just want to bang each other? Because I think they just are fucking their way back to themselves.
Back to each other. Wow.
Yeah.
You have blown this thing wide open, maybe. I mean, yeah, you can. I think you can read it that way. They're certainly obsessed with each other, aren't they?
Yeah.
And there is the closeness when they're together. Mm. And the men talk about them braiding each other's hair. Is that euphemistic? Who
oh.
knows? But neither of them ever wears comfortable shoes, so I guess that's out. So I'm really confused. The signals are mixed.
I think there is a massive sapphic subtext in here that these women would be happier but probably less like successful if they just owned a B&B together in New England.
I mean, I don't know, what's our measure of success? Surely a New
yeah,
England B&B.
That is the perfect measure of success. So that's my theory.
Wow.
Final question. Mm. I couldn't let you go without asking you this question. Can you cast this movie for me?
Oh God. Oh, that's interesting. Fiery redhead. You might almost want a Julia Roberts type, right?
Yeah, a kind of Erin Brockovich era.
Yeah.
This is for Topaz.
Exactly, for Topaz, yeah.
Or I was thinking My Cousin Vinny era Marissa Tomei.
Cool. Yeah, we'll go for that. Yeah, yeah. For Rowena, I mean, an icy blonde should not be difficult.
There's less of them around these days, I feel.
I suppose. Rosamund Pike, Naomi Watts, one of those kind of people.
Who's like the 22, 23-year-old
version of that?
Yeah, because she kind of need to be younger.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The Marissa Tomei.
I thought we were time traveling.
No, we are time traveling. Okay, yeah, we want like a Michelle Pfeiffer or Sharon Stone.
Oh, Michelle Pfeiffer would be great at it, but her British accent, maybe, I'm not sure.
No, I'm not sure about her accent. Michael Krebs.
Michael Krebs, I'll tell you who I'd go for. If you want to make him attractive, which you do, mm-hmm. What I'd almost be attempted to do would be Sam Elliott circa Roadhouse. Now, if you do a Google image search for Sam Elliott circa Roadhouse, that's a sexy older man.
Oh, yeah.
I think he was probably a bit too old for Krebs, but you'd make an exception.
I wouldn't say no to Sam Elliott today, though.
Well, no, who would?
Yeah, I mean, I saw him in A Star Is Born, mm-hmm. and I had no idea what he was saying, but I'd still get up on that.
With
then.
That voice, I mean,
yeah. Oh.
So that would be a good, you know, that voice, it would instantly be a really good way of communicating the fact that Michael Krebs is super, super, super duper hot. Mm-hmm. So that would work.
Is there anybody else? I feel like all the other characters just fall by the wayside.
I mean, Joe Goldstein and Topaz's other love interest.
Nathan. We never mentioned that. After Nathan dies, she immediately gets off with his protege.
Protege, yeah.
And then they get married. And
who's still more than 10 years older than her, just in case you were worried. Literally any bland, extremely handsome actor would mm-hmm. be fine.
I feel like Nathan, that guy from New Girl.
Oh, yeah, Jake Johnson.
Yes, Jake Johnson. He'd be just great. Kind of a nice schlubby guy. You know, a nice schlub.
Yeah, okay, I can go with that.
Yeah. I think the weird thing is that, like, obviously there are lots of characters that come in and out, but all you really care about is those three, right?
Yeah,
Rowena,
much.
Topaz, and Michael Krebs. The worst man alive.
He's not in the top 10 best, is he? Yeah, he's pretty disappointing.
So, would you recommend people read Career Girls?
I mean, recommend is such a strong word. I had a really good fun with it. It's you know, as you say, it races along nicely.
Yeah.
You keep reading it. It's very, very
readable. It's 450 pages long and it races.
Yeah, it's 450 pages long and I can certainly read it in well under a day. Like, it's very, very simple that way. I would say which were the other ones I liked of hers? Tall Poppies and the Movie.
Oh, Tall Poppies is the Movie.
Sorry, no, there's also a book called The Movie.
I see.
So confusing. Yeah. But no, and then she got, basically after she sort of got into politics and had children and got married, she basically cut all the sex scenes out of her book. So anything written after about 2000 is completely sexless. Still can be a good read,
right?
But do
and
be
also,
aware.
If you're politically unsure of Louise Mensch, you can just go for the Bagshaw years. Is that a good...
I would absolutely do
okay.
that. Yeah.
Cool. Well, Helen O'Hara, thank you so much for being
pleasure.
On the Mental Garbage. You have been fantastic.
Thank you.
Is there anything you want to plug?
Nah, you know, I'm just out there. I'm on
social media.
I'm on Twitter, Helen L. O'Hara, and I plug things there. So, but okay. I also do other things like retell jokes. So it's all good.
Okay, and you also do the Empire podcast.
I also do the Empire podcast.
Good, so, good deal, though.
Yeah. So if you're into film and don't mind idiots harping on nonsensically about it, then we're right there.
Now get those curves out of here. Poured into that lumberjack shirt.
I mean, it's not very Career Girls, is it? I'm sorry.
Come on, give us a spin.
I should have worn my Prada, my Gucci, but no.
Thanks, Adam. This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Zaroline, or email me by the podcast at ZarolineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast produced by Hannah Varrell.